Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. On Monday, Ismail Sabri Yaakob's government and Pakatan Harapan leadership signed the MOU on Transformation and Political Stability, which promises to implement a slew of institutional reforms and not to dissolve parliament before July 31st of 2022. Now, in exchange for this, Pakatan will also give a conditional promise to support budget 2022 and all related supply bills. So the implementation of reforms under the MOU has been divided into three phases: what will be done immediately, what will be done within this year, and what will be done within the first half of next year. And that means that Parliament only has a total of just 9 months to make good on this reform package. Will Parliament be able to prove skeptics wrong? Dr. Bridget Welsh of the Asia Research Institute at University of Nottingham, Malaysia, joins us now. Bridget, good evening. Today, Warisan's Shafi Afdal chastised Pakatan Harapan for signing this MOU with the federal government. He says that he claims that they're working with the people that had stolen their mandate, if I may quote his words. And I believe he's not alone in thinking this, Bridget. This MOU is still somewhat contentious, despite being touted as historical, as being a game changer. I'm wondering, Bridget, how you're evaluating this. How do we best evaluate this MOU, and what are your yardsticks?
Well, I think at first it's important to recognize that these institutional reforms do benefit all Malaysians, in the sense of the parliamentary reform, changes in the way the constituency allocations, the judicial independence, term limits, anti-hoppy loans, so forth. These things are beneficial, but they are things that most people will not feel. And I think that as a consequence, even though there's no promise of changing COVID relationships and COVID policy, the impact on people directly is minimal. And I think that as a consequence, we do see this as very much as a political deal, that serves the interests of elites, largely for the elites, even though it's been couched in terms of issues associated with kind of changes of the institutions. But these are not things that are people that are going to be able to have any concrete impact for most people immediately. And I think this is something Shafi Afdal is focusing on. We see a recognition that this is actually the key people who benefit in this the current government, Ismail Sabri, and many of the elite interests. So we can see, for example, the opposition is focused on trying to reduce the power of UMNO, and in a sense, in this context, buff up itself by trying to legitimize itself by having these reforms, but not necessarily those that kind of impact immediately ordinary Malaysians.
Bridget, do you think that this was, in fact, the best possible deal considering the current configuration and also taking for granted that Ismail Sabri was in no position to change the current configuration, i.e. essentially the Perikatan National Government in a different garb?
I think that the deal focuses heavy on institutional dimensions and not enough on kind of policy issues that could actually affect ordinary Malaysians. So I think that this deal was very elite-centered, very opportunistically done on things that were already in the political discussions, anti-hopping, UNDI 18, which, by the way, would have gone forward even without this deal. So I think that the more substantive dimensions that would have affected ordinary Malaysians, I think, could have been more fleshed out. But I think that it is still a good deal in the sense that many of these institutional reforms were unlikely to gain any traction when you have a very polarized political situation. So by making this type of deal, you do put in place very difficult issues of institutional reforms that are particularly challenging in the Malaysian context because of the nature of the way the politics is fragmented. But there are costs. costs, right? And I think these costs will be for the opposition in terms of it will affect the way that they're standing among their political base. I don't think they're going to gain more political supporters from making this deal. In fact, I think that we're going to see more divided opposition and more alternative opposition actors try to garner support from, as a result of the fact that the key Pakatan Harapan is seen as supporting the current government, which in terms of its policy outcomes and in terms of addressing things such as COVID-19, is not as successful. And I think that there are huge risks for Pakatan Harapan in terms of supporting this particular deal. And this is why we see they're so lauding it, saying this is a landmark deal. But in terms of ordinary Malaysians, I think that's not necessarily the case.
Right. Bridget, can I ask you, I mean, so about not just about the people who support this deal, but those who don't. So who might, say, not be happy with this deal? I'm wondering whether, sabotage might be likely, if anyone might have, say, a vested interest in seeing this MOU fail.
So first of all, I think it's important to recognize that many elements of the deal are very general. And when we get to specific measures of reform, specific laws, it's always the devils that are in the details. And I think this is something that's going to be very important to see how they evolve. There are lots of points of conflict that can emerge. In terms of what we've seen in reforms in the context of Malaysia is that you need to have stakeholders that are actually vested in them. And that means you need the bureaucracy. It can't just be a law. It has to be changing practices and getting people vested in changing those practices. Many of these particular initiatives are really very, they're legal and they're superficial in the sense that, they change the laws, but they don't change how they're implemented. And much of the resistance for many of these measures are going to come from the ground, from the bureaucracy, from within the political parties. For example, in India 18, one of the reasons that I think India 18 has not moved forward is because the current elections commissioner and the EC chairman is not necessarily supportive of this. And so you have stakeholders in the bureaucracy that need to be brought into these conversations, and they need to be more have more ownership in these reforms. I see, I'm deeply concerned that they are still very superficial because there is a lack of stakeholders. And the other component is that it's bringing in the ordinary public and connecting them to that. I think that this is something for Pakatan Harapan supporters, but many of those who are non-Pakatan Harapan supporters supporting the current government need to understand the benefits of these reforms for themselves. And I think those are not necessarily clear because of the highly polarized nature of the way reforms have been discussed.
Bridget, some critics sort of suggest that Pakatan will become a toothless tiger as a consequence of this MOU. Of course, there are protestations from Pakatan side who say, no, that's not true. They could pull out. And if we go back to the reasons why Ismail Sabri wanted this MOU in the first place, what does it suggest about his own support base, 114 that he's supposed to have, that suggests in some sense that Pakatan threats to pull out or end an MOU might actually be much more significant than people give it credit for?
Well, I think the winner in this deal, besides the needed institutional reforms, is Ismail Sabri's government. I mean, he's given 9 months without having to focus on worrying about the political negotiations and numbers and others. And of course, in that context, he's given a time to basically to build a legacy. And at the same time, if he chooses to, or component parties choose to introduce things like religious laws that will alienate the opposition, what we can see is that the impact will be is that it will be the burden will be on the opposition to pull out, and they'll be the one that will be responsible for bringing the government down. So in a sense, I think that Ismail Sabri has been given much more power in this equation and political base. And in fact, I think that, you know, my projection going down the line is that there will inevitably be issues that will force Pakatan Harapan to leave the deal. And the question is whether or not it's sooner rather than later. My sense is that if elections are going to be later, that this will probably be later. But I think that there's inevitably going to be issues that are going to be very difficult for Pakatan Harapan to deal with in terms of its political base. I think most of those issues are going to be around race and religion, which are issues that inevitably the current government will use to try to build up their own political base, because the nature of politics in the country has not shifted. I think that the opposition sees this as sort of, you know, being able to have some deliverables to change the political landscape. And in particular, they're able to kind of neutralize some of the kind of more issues in UMNO, or the more the court custer elements in UMNO. That said, I think that they're much higher risk for the opposition. We have seen in parts of the experience of Europe and other coalition governments is that when political parties get into deals that are seen to alienate their political base, that they have that has profound impact on the base of those political parties. And I think Pakatan Harapan has chosen, by making this deal, even if it is a deal that they've given them lots of exit outs and others, it still is a deal that I think that most of its political base have difficulty accepting, because it means working with a government that has not performed in any meaningful way, given that most of the actors in the current government are still the same actors of the past. And so as a consequence, I think that they're going to have a hard time selling to their political base unless the governance fundamentally changes. But I think that in some ways is somewhat optimistic.
Bridget, can I get you to elaborate a little bit on that? Just to elaborate a little bit on that, about what needs to be communicated, because you're absolutely right that perhaps Pakatan Harapan might be alienating some of their support base, but they're arguing that this is for this is bipartisanship, that this is for the greater good. Can you share a little bit of your thoughts on how you think this needs to be communicated to the public, particularly as you say that some of the reforms seem to be elite-centric?
I think, you know, the fact is most of these measures are not seen to actually benefit the lives of ordinary Malaysians. And they're very distant from their lives, and they're very general, right? And this is where I think if we think about the specific measures like, MA63, well, what does that mean for people in Sabah and Sarawak meaningfully, all right? It's like a political promise as opposed to something that is substantive that changes their well-being. And I think that this particular, the political discourse and the political components of this deal don't go down. And I think the one measure that is in terms of improving the COVID response, I think is going to be in a very important central point of where there can be traction that can have some meaningful impact. At this point, for most people, these things don't necessarily have the same traction. And so you have to look at the particular components and then flesh out what they mean in terms of specific measures and policies. And so far, that is part of the conversations that will likely happen as things move forward. And I think that my sense is that there's going to be a minimalist approach adopted by the government and a more pressure to expand that on the part of the opposition. So there will be ongoing conversations and ongoing negotiations, of which at points that helps to build trust and helps to forge bipartisanship, but it also opens up the avenues for points of difference, particularly in areas that are the more controversial elements within these reforms, such as the anti-hopping bill.
Right. Bridget, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. That was Dr. Bridget Welsh of the Asia Research Institute at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more after this, so stay tuned to Consider This. Hello, thank you so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Now we're taking a closer look at the deliverables in the Transformation Political Stability MOU, as well as the timeline to implement the reforms promised. Tricia Yeo joins us now. She's the CEO of the think tank Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or better known as IDEAS. Tricia, good evening. Thank you for being on the show tonight. You know, there's only 9 months for the reforms under this MOU to be implemented, and that's not very long to think about how many reforms that they've agreed to. Is the timeline for delivery realistic to you?
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me on. Good evening. I think, firstly, this really is a historic moment for Malaysian politics and democracy generally, and for institutional reforms. Many of the things contained in the MOU are things that we've been fighting for so many years, from the civil society or even the think tank community, things that we believe should have been in place for such a long time, right? Parliamentary reforms, basic things that any Westminster democracy should have upheld. So in the first instance, I think we've issued statements saying that we welcome it. We congratulated both the government and the opposition for signing this and sealing the deal. As to whether the timeline, whether there's sufficient time, I do admit that when I read the long list of things that were in, I felt firstly quite surprised and pleasantly surprised, but I also felt that that would be quite a long laundry list to achieve by July of next year. However, I would put two caveats to my doubt. One is that some of the reforms actually have very clear stipulated deadlines. So some of them, like Undi 18, need to be, and the anti-hopping law as well, like need to be tabled and passed, I think, within the first quarter of next year. And then everything to do with COVID and the budget and the fiscal injection and all that needs to be done by this year, right, by the end of this year. So there are some quite clear timelines that need to be met, failing which, and if the agreement is to be followed to letter by letter, word for word, then I think either side of the parties can actually pull out from the agreement. Presumably, in this case, it would be the opposition. The other second point is that the memorandum only says that dissolution is not to happen before the 31st of July, but that's not to say that it cannot be extended any further. And therefore, the length and the duration of which the agreement can be applied, from my understanding, can be extended beyond July because it applies as long as dissolution has not yet taken place. So hopefully that will allow us, allow them more time to execute those changes and reforms.
Tricia, so, you know, of the some of the immediate reforms, actually, or in fact, the timetables for implementation, parliamentary reforms under the immediate category, and that might take us, you know, mean that in the next month or so, we should see some real movement with regard to those reforms. How are you going to be monitoring this process, you know, over the coming months? In order to kind of demonstrate to yourself, at least, that this is not just a lot of hot-end rhetoric, that this is actually quite substantial?
Yeah, I think the first thing that they can and already should be doing is thinking about the parliamentary select committees and also elevating the status of the opposition leader. So again, like in many parliaments and Westminster systems around the world, the convention is that the opposition leader is accorded the same rights and status as you know, as the prime minister in waiting, right? So these are some of the things that we would be watching out for immediately. The longer term things, of course, we would have to wait till maybe end of the year or next year for some of these draft bills to be tabled in parliament. But the parliamentary select committees, definitely, that would be the first thing that we would be looking out for, because you know there are many things that can be done immediately, and it's just a matter of putting them in place, making sure that the sufficient numbers of MPs are nominated, appointed into the parliamentary select committees, more members of the opposition, for instance, and making sure that it's more equal representation from the backbencher side and from the opposition side. I mean, the other thing I didn't mention earlier, which were actually not very clearly stated as well in the agreement, are things like on MA63, on the independence of the judiciary. So these are just, you know, one to two sentences, and it's really difficult to say what exactly they had hoped to achieve, but I think inserting it in is better than not inserting it generally. Those are the things that I would be looking at immediately.
Can I just focus, just stay on the topic of parliamentary reforms? I mean, one of the things I think that why there's such skepticism around this MOU is that I think the larger public doesn't quite understand how these particular reforms might benefit us. So, for instance, with parliamentary reform, Tricia, maybe you can explain a little bit why these particular reforms would benefit the larger public.
Yeah, so I think it boils down to really educating ourselves. So, yeah, it's not just about the public, but it's me and you, right, about mm-hmm. what the roles and duties are of a member of parliament, of a parliamentarian. It goes back to how, for historical reasons and community reasons, we've always depended on our MPs or aduns as constituency service providers, where it's just really about welfare provision and connecting us to the right sources of cash aid, for instance, especially in the kampung areas where they are dependent upon for a lot more than that. It's like, you know, when somebody dies, you're expected to have the MP give out money and so on. My point is that they really need to graduate away from this. And one way to do that is to ensure that Parliament is actually given the right robust strengthening so that they can play their duties of examining policies and amend if the laws if necessary, or enact new laws which are needed, amend very outdated laws, you know, refresh the entire legal and policy framework to ensure that Malaysia's on the right track. So much of the time, we're complaining that our MPs are not policy-minded, that they're caring more about the numbers game, about the political game, and they don't care about the actual needs of the rakyat economy and so on. And so we got to actually, you know, put our money where our mouth is and say that if we want the MPs to truly become much more professionalized and do the thinking on behalf of the people, then we need to also be able to relieve them of their welfare duties. And, you know, that's a different story altogether. But we also need them to actually play their roles in doing the research and very difficult, challenging task of understanding the policies that are needed to transform the country and move us forward. So, you know, having the Parliamentary Services Act, which would require and provide much more resources to hire staff to support the parliamentary select committees, because there's not enough staffing at the moment. I mean, some of the staff actually support several select committees, and so it's just not enough to go around. They need more researchers, really building it up in a way that other parliaments actually do function well. And then you can see that this kind of robust discussion is going to happen. So one thing I'm happy to see at least is that from this MOU, that it allows policy competition and policy debate to take place, things that we agree or we disagree on in the MOU, at least that allows us the space to debate it. But of course, it has to come in parallel. Yeah.
Right, Tricia, it seems like, and I can see why it's very important for people are thinking about politics in structural terms, in institutional terms, like yourself. But there seems to be a kind of missing link for a lot of ordinary Malaysians who perhaps, you know, like myself, might be quite politically illiterate about the importance of, say, recognizing, you know, the parliamentary opposition leader as having equal status as a minister. I mean, that is being read as a self-serving move to, you know, for Anwar Ibrahim, for instance, rather than as a move to towards more maturity and in line with best practices internationally. I mean, do you think that driven by policy wonks, this MOU has failed to communicate its historic? I mean, I know the media is constantly saying it's historic, but they're just, you know, parroting what they're being told to parrot, but do they really understand why it is historical or historic, rather?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right in that sense that the communication piece could be stronger. At least from our point of view in a think tank that has been harping on some of these reform items, maybe we're also stuck in a little bit of a bubble on our own. We definitely see this as a good thing, right? But I think you're right, like, to the common man on the street, like, why should they care about parliamentary reforms? I think the linking and the linkages of the story and the narrative are not being made strongly enough. Well, I mean, hopefully the COVID-related issues, that should be quite strong. I mean, you're talking about an additional, what, 10 billion ringgit being distributed to 11 million people. There is also definitely fiscal injection of, what, an additional 45 billion into the budget. So those are things that, I mean, hopefully they're completely undisputed, right? The fact that we need to have more cash aid for people. The institutional reforms, I think it's always been difficult to make that convincing argument for the public at large. But, I mean, from where I stand, it's clear that this will actually lead to better outcomes because more research and more investment is being made into these kinds of policy and these policy outcomes. But I mean, having said that, there are even other reforms that I hope that I was hoping to see that did not come in. But I understand there's always a negotiation in place, and I'm sure that there were certain parties who tried very hard, but they just, you know, couldn't get it in. But yes, I agree. The communication needs to be stronger.
Tricia, thank you so much for helping us put that into context. I appreciate your time and you joining us on the show. That was Tricia Yeo of Ideas. Now, that's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. But don't forget to get the latest news and information on COVID-19 vaccines on our website, astroawani.com, as well as the Astro Awani app. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching. Good night.
Good night.